listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Now, if Obamacare was demonstrated to double your probability of dying in the hospital, what do you think conservatives would say? Let's do away with it. If going to public school doubled your probability of committing suicide, oh, well, let's just do private schools. Just anything except maybe having guns around. Well, this new study, researchers at the University of California, San Francisco, just did a study of 15 different studies and concluded, I'll just read the story. Again, we still don't have that damn URL printing at the bottom of the page here. Remind me at the end of the show and I'll fix it myself, okay? Thank you. So I don't know where this came from, but it's Benita Matilda wrote this. This is from Science World Report. And she wrote, researchers at the University of California, San Francisco claim that people who have easy access to guns are 2 times more likely to commit suicide or to be murdered. 100% more likely. Well, let's ask Neil McCabe what he thinks about that. Conservative commentator, editor of the Guns and Patriots newsletter, neilwmccabe.com is his website. Neil, welcome back to the program.
Hey, glad to be with you, Tom. I know when you said a study of studies, that's almost like grant writers porn to have a study of studies. That's
amazing. Well, all 15 studies came essentially to this conclusion. There were slight variations in their methodology or in their statistics, but you look over 15 different studies on the availability. Basically, what they're saying is that if you've got a gun in the house, you're twice as likely to either use it for homicide or suicide than if you don't, or to commit homicide or suicide than if you don't have a gun in the house. That's pretty startling.
Well, did the study talk about those people who would be murdered? Because obviously, a lot of people have firearms.
It doesn't matter whose gun it is.
In danger.
Doesn't matter whose gun it is.
Well,
every single day, children in this country die
because they feel in danger, and the fact that somebody actually succeeds in killing them is evidence that their life was in danger.
If what you're suggesting is that, for example, abused spouses, typically women, but sometimes husbands, that abused spouses go out and get guns to protect themselves and their abusive spouses then use the guns against them. You and I both know the statistics are overwhelmingly on the other side. That is that the abusers are the ones who have the guns when those guns get used.
Well, be that as it may, I have no problem with if a spouse is feeling abused and they feel that their life is in danger, I would recommend if they feel comfortable with it, I would encourage them to have a gun to protect themselves.
And their abusive spouse will get that gun and kill them.
Well, I mean, that's control over that. Of course, with suicides, it's actually something that I dealt with when I was in Iraq. Dealing as a combat historian, I had the chance to interview people who were involved in the problem of military suicides, and it just so happens that one of the tragedies of having a firearm is that if someone has a suicidal gesture, and in many cases people aren't making sincere attempts to commit suicide. They're creating a situation as their sort of last reaching out for help. But, unlike an overdose or a hanging that you've arranged, at the same time that your wife comes back from the store, there's no margin of error. Most attempts of suicide with a firearm are successful. And I think that's sort of the nature of the beast, as is jumping off a bridge or jumping in front of a bus.
Except that very few people do those things because those are viewed as, gory and awful, whereas guns are designed to kill. So if you're using a gun in the way that it's designed and one points it at oneself, it will cause death. Aren't you making my point right now, Neil?
Well, what I'm trying to say, Tom, is I'm trying to approach this, just sort of ad hoc, objectively, as an American who's concerned about other Americans.
Right.
And it is a realistic problem that when people make these sort of gestures, the gesture is unfortunately too successful with firearms.
Right.
At the same time, predicting suicide or suicide prevention is a very fuzzy, fuzzy science, and it's certainly not justification to disarm Americans from a right that's protected in the Constitution.
Well, we can argue whether or not that's a right protected in the Constitution. That's
a whole different
discussion. But we have the example of Australia. In 1996, Australia, basically the entire country, after one of these mass shootings, you know, sort of like their version of Newtown, the entire country said, okay, that's it, screw it. And now in Australia, if you want to have a gun, you've got to have actually a reason to have a gun. Now, that reason can be that you're a hunter or that you're a sports shooter or that you are a, you're in law enforcement or that you, you know, carry large amounts of money or something like that. But you have to have a reason and you have to have a permit. And hundreds of thousands of guns were turned in. And what has happened since 1996? It's been, 15 years now. And the suicide rate has gone down. And the homicide rate has gone down, and they haven't had a mass shooting since then.
But I would be very careful with suicide statistics, Tom, because, as you know, there's a lot of shame, and there's a lot of sort of fiddling in the middle because making sure that a family gets an insurance claim. So a lot of times a suicide will be ruled an accident or something like that, and certainly in the military, there are suicides that are portrayed to the family or recorded as a combat death or something. It's fairly obvious if someone is found with a gun in their hand and they're dead what happened. But if someone's taking pills or doing something else that caused the suicide, it's less obvious and it's more susceptible.
But in Australia,
both
suicide by gun went down.
Would be fudged.
Both suicide by gun went down and suicides went down. That was actually one of the studies that was part of these 15 studies.
Obviously violence by guns would go down, but did the murder rate go down? Are people killing less time?
Yes.
They're killing. The homicide is down.
Homicide is down and suicides are down. Although suicides, I think, is the one that I'm most fascinated by. But yes, homicide and suicide.
I'd have to look to see how they've done that because what you're suggesting is that there's actually been a change in human nature.
No, I don't think this is the exact same thing that you were just talking about in Iraq. If you can easily grab a gun and you have an impulse towards suicide, then you're more likely to be successful in your suicide. If you can easily grab a gun and you have an impulse toward assaulting someone and you assault them with a gun instead of a baseball bat, they're more likely to die.
Well, I'm telling you right now,
fist.
Where I'm standing, if I had the impulse to kill someone and I didn't have a gun, I mean, I'm looking around this room right now and there are things I could do to kill somebody.
No, but I mean, look at this guy in the movie theater last week who killed the guy who threw popcorn at him in the movie theater, the guy who was texting. If that guy hadn't had a gun, if he had just gone over and gotten in a fist fight with the guy would still be alive.
Well, I mean, that very well could be true. I mean,
I think it almost certainly is true. So isn't there an argument for only, but, you know, in this case, I mean, you know, this guy was a retired cop, so you could argue that he had at least a right or a reason to have a gun. Well, actually, I don't think he had a reason to be a gun.
No, I don't know if a retired cop has a reason to, but in and of the fact that every American should be able to carry a weapon, but certainly if he's trying to use a knife, certainly not.
Why? I mean, slavery is an anachronism. We took it out of the Constitution. Isn't it time to take guns out of the Constitution and say this is an anachronism too?
Well, I mean, I would welcome you taking that to a convention or getting it passed through the necessary process, Tom.
Yeah, well, yeah. Good luck with that, right?
Well,
Neil McCabe, especially with the NRA out there. Neil McCabe, neilwmccabe.com is his website. Neil, thanks for dropping by.
Nice to be with you, Tom. Take care.
Always nice having a thoughtful conversation. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So should we say, hey, you know, the Second Amendment should go the way of slavery? After all, it was enacted in part to enforce slavery. And welcome back. Andrew Campbell on the line with us, senior producer with The Big Picture. Hey, Andrew, how you doing?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. This is the problem with libertarianism. What's that?
Yeah, we're going to be talking about the leftovers of the West Virginia chemical spill. Yesterday, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin, who is technically a Democrat, held a news conference And he was asked about whether it's safe for West Virginians to drink the water. And he said, basically, I'm not a scientist. If you want to drink it. If you don't, don't. And the problem is that approach is he's taking a very libertarian approach because he's basically ignoring the precautionary principle. And he's basically assuming that we're all scientists. We don't need regulations. We can decide for ourselves. And that's just not how the system works.
Yeah.
We'll be getting into that.
Yeah. A good one. And we're going to that will be the first question for Tim Kavanaugh and Adam Beitley.
Yeah, we'll start off with that. We'll also get into fracking down in Texas. Fracking has reportedly been linked to 30 earthquakes in a small Texas town. And really get into the fact of, is this acceptable? Is this what energy independence means in America, that a town has to have 30 earthquakes? We'll talk about that. We'll be getting into a new study that says people who have access to guns are more likely to commit suicide and be victims of homicide. Seems kind of self-explanatory, but it's a great discussion to have and why we really need to curb gun usage in the country and put in some sensible reform.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll also be talking about privatization. We'll get into a little bit about unions, and we'll finish off talking about economic inequality in the country.
Should be an interesting conversation. Then want to eat healthy? Move to the Netherlands? Really?
Yeah, we'll be talking to Gawain Kripke. He's the Director of Policy, Food Security and Hunger with Oxfam.
Mm-hmm.
And really be getting into how in the U.S. healthy food just isn't available these days. It's junk food most of the time. And what is healthy is extremely expensive, and the average American can't afford it. But in Europe, they've found a way to do healthy food for less, and we'll be getting into that.
Yeah. I find it fascinating. I wonder if it's that they have less of a fast food industry than we do, or that they emphasize, you know, is it a cultural thing? What is it? Because, you know, it's like I saw a blog post the other day. Somebody was pointing out that, you know, a lean breast of chicken that's just, you know, lightly steamed, whatever, can cost you $7 or $8 in a restaurant. But, you know, chicken wings, you know, you could buy at a fast food joint for like $1, you know, covered with fat and oil and slathered with. So it's like, you know, what's wrong with this picture? I mean, it's just.
Exactly.
So anyhow, and excuse me. More proof we're standing in an extinction event?
Yeah, you'll be talking about some new research that's come out. It includes revelations how ancient moss is revealing that Arctic warming is basically unprecedented over the last 44,000 years. We'll also talk about the cold air that much of the country is facing right now and what that might have to do with climate change.
At 44,000 years ago, that might, I mean, typically the timeline is used as 20,000 years ago, that the land bridge existed between Asia and North America, that some Native Americans crossed. Others in South America appear that they came by sea, but interesting thought. And then the police. We're going to talk about the police in the Daily Tech.
Yeah, we'll talk about why we need to be investing more in community policing.
There you go. Andrew Campbell. Thank you, Andrew.
Thanks, Tom.
Good talking with you. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Oh, this is interesting. Medicaid expansion, it turns out, isn't just giving more people access to health care. It's actually improving mental health, because people are not crazed about what happens if I get sick, or people who actually have conditions like, you know, diabetes or high blood pressure, something that requires regular medication, are not worried about being able to pay for their medication or have access to it, or being able to make sure that they're doing the right amount by going to the doctor periodically and getting checked. It's fascinating. This step by step, you know. Now, meanwhile, there's a conservative attempt to dismantle Obamacare that Mitch McConnell just signed on to. And this is that there's basically this risk pool created for insurance companies by Obamacare, and it's funded by taxpayers. And this thing sunsets, by the way, in 2016. The assumption is that by then we won't need it. But, you know, just for the rollout, some insurance companies, depending on which states they're operating, depending on what plans they put together, may end up with some with more older, sicker people and fewer younger, healthy people, and they might lose money on Obamacare, and other insurance companies might make a huge profit on Obamacare. And so this kind of risk pool for the insurance companies was set up so that if insurance companies lose money, we'll cover them. And, you know, one of the conservative comments about Obamacare is that this, you know, this is a, there's 100 different moving parts in this thing, which is true. And it's why I think, you know, hey, just Medicare Part E, single payer. Let's just offer everybody in America Medicare. And the easy way to do that, by the way, is to simply amend Obamacare to add a public option to it. Because then you can choose Medicare or you can choose your health insurance company. I mean, this, after all, is what President Obama campaigned on in 2008. But in any case, they're saying, let's just legislatively do away with this risk pool. Which, of course, is going to cause the insurance companies to say, really? We don't want to play in this game anymore. You guys don't have our back. Or we're not guaranteed profitability. And, you know, it actually, I mean, you know, there's a populist element to this that might actually cause it to work, because people generally hate insurance companies. And what the Republicans are saying is, why are our tax dollars making sure that the insurance companies don't lose money? Now, the easy answer to that is that because Obamacare is a Republican plan, it was developed by the Heritage Foundation or Institute or whatever they call it, and it was put into place by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts, the Republican governor. It is a Republican plan. It was first proposed by Richard Nixon. The Democratic plan was always Medicare for everybody. Harry Truman in 1947 proposed that everybody be covered by a national health insurance program, single payer. That's always been the Democrats' plan. Obamacare is a Republican plan, but it was put forward by a Democratic president in a time when Republicans, you know, had, at the time it passed, I don't think they had control of the House of Representatives, but they had basically control of the Senate in as much as they could filibuster things, they could block things. And so there were all these compromises made to get enough Republicans to vote for this thing. Plus, there were these conservadems, you know, the Max Baucuses of the world, who had to be mollified. And so, you know, we ended up with a Republican health care plan as a national health care plan. And because it's a Republican health care plan, it uses private companies and makes money for them and guarantees them a profit. So the Republicans now are saying, you know, we know the problems with our own plan. If we pull out this guaranteed profitability piece, which is only going to be in effect for the first 2 years while the program kind of adjusts itself, right? Because presumably after 2 years, the health insurance companies will know, and this is apparently how it worked in Massachusetts too. After the end of 2 years, the health insurance companies all know, you know, okay, here's what we should set our rates at, here's where our risks are, here's, you know, here's who's going to sign up. They just, you know, now you can do the math. So if you pull that thing out in the first 2 years, you crash Obamacare. And believe it or not, this is the new thing that they're trying to do. Now, at the same time that they're trying to do that, this is the absolute strangest thing. Mitch McConnell, while he's trying to do this, he is running television ads back in Kentucky, saying that Mitch helps get health care for people. Here's part of the ad. This is this guy. He's whispering. Listen.
These days, I don't have much of a voice, but I and so many Kentuckians have been helped by someone with a strong voice, Mitch McConnell.
Okay, this guy's whispering because he says, you know, I worked with radioactive materials. I got throat cancer. Mitch McConnell passed legislation that actually provided $150,000 cash payment to anybody who got radiation from working with this materials. McConnell also ignored the plant and the dangers of the plant, and, you know, he was I mean, there's a really sordid story behind this thing. But net, this guy is the McConnell campaign is saying, you know, Mitch got me health care, government funded health care. This guy didn't even have to join Obamacare or anything. I got it because he worked at this factory that was handling radioactive material. Isn't it kind of weird that at the same time that you're trying to dismantle a healthcare program for the country, you're running an ad in your home state talking about how you're the champion of government-funded healthcare? Very strange. We'll be back. It's 28 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And should we consider saying, you know, it's time to repeal the Second Amendment, just like we repealed slavery? Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, brought to you by the efforts to free an American political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman at free-don.org. What? It's brought to you by free-don.org? Who's paying for that? Nobody. I am deciding to say it. This is my, I support this. Me. Don Siegelman's a good guy. He should not be sitting in prison. He should particularly not be sitting in prison because the judge gave lousy jury instructions saying that something that was not a crime could be, under law, could be considered. I'm getting into the technicalities. You can read all about it over free-don.org. Anyhow, welcome back. I also want to get into, as we continue through our day here, there's a bunch of stuff we're gonna get into in the next hour or two. Alan Brundrett is gonna be with us, who is the mayor of Azle, Texas, a city where they're having shall we say a few problems with fracking. And in our third hour, we're gonna be talking about extinction events and global warming. But also, I wanted to point out to you that there's a fellow in New York. 84-year-old, his name is Quang, Wong is his last name. I've got to find his first name. According to eyewitness Ian King, Wong did not, Kang Wong. He, 84 years old, he doesn't speak any English. And a police officer tried to stop him for jaywalking, and he tried to walk away, and the police officer just beat the bejesus out of him, apparently. And according to the chief of police, apparently he fell in the street, and the police didn't beat him up. What I'm guessing the police officer didn't realize is that this 84-year-old man has a 47-year-old son who is a lawyer and who is going after him, going after the police. They're filing a lawsuit against the son, 41-year-old son, excuse me. His son, a 41-year-old lawyer, claimed, this is from the Think Progress blog, Karama Towns writing about it, claims he was given little information after receiving a phone call from officers inquiring about his father's medication. Police refused to tell him where Wong was located for hours, he said, before he was finally able to locate him on his own. Eyewitnesses told the New York Post the police brutally beat him, while New York Police Commissioner Bill Bratton contends Kang Wong incurred the injuries from a fall. He was left bloodied and hospitalized. So what do we do about that? I think that, you know, we need to be paying our police the same as we pay any other profession. We need to treat policing as a profession, pay our police as professionals, and then hold them to professional standards. It's pretty straightforward stuff. But, well, it's just pretty straightforward stuff. But, you know, apparently we're not, at least that holding them to the standards. I think New York City cops are paid fairly well, but although I frankly don't know. everything I hear from the right wingers is that they're members of a union, therefore they must be making too much money. But hey, a lot on the table here today. Hank in Fort Morgan, Colorado. Hey, Hank, what's up?
I wanted to take a look at this gun control thing at a view. Being prior law enforcement.
Hank, you're breaking up.
I heard.
Hank, you're gonna have to call back. Are you on a cell phone? Yeah. Call me back. I'm sorry. I'm getting every third word, maybe if that. Richard in Seattle, and instead you disagree with me, I'd love to talk to you. Richard in Seattle, watching Free Speech TV. What's up, Richard?
Well, yeah, I've read some books on suicide, and over 50% of the suicides are actually created by impulsive behavior.
And I would guess that's probably true of homicides as well.
And also, I don't know what I actually almost impulsively threw myself in front of a car at one particular time.
Yikes.
Because so much stress. I was homeless, a drug problem. I don't want to go into the whole details.
Right.
But I, before that, never even thought about killing myself. And just because my situation was so bad,
right,
that I almost did it.
Well, this takes us back to that study that was published by the BBC back in 2003 that shows that over a 100-year period, they looked at this, and whenever the Conservatives were in charge of England or Australia, suicide rates went up. And whenever the Liberals were in charge, the Labor Party, suicide rates went down. And I think you're making a case for that. When people are in desperate situations, they start thinking about desperate measures. Richard, thanks for calling and sharing your story and that statistic with us. Gerald in Denver. Hey, Gerald.
Hi, yes. How's it going, Tom?
Good. You want to talk about Republicans?
Yes. I mean, they're domestic terrorists. Every single step of progress we've ever had in this country has always been stood in front of by lying, most-time, super-religious conservatives. How come we just can't brand them as domestic terrorists? When they show up to government, they get to be a Guam or Puerto Rico. You get to show up, but you don't get to vote on them.
Well, I'd be more inclined to, let them create their own, to find a state that they all want to move to and secede. I think that we can actually make a case for obstructionists and conservatives. William F. Buckley famously said, a conservative is a man who stands astride the arc of history with his hand stretched out shouting stop. And I think that there's a place in society for somebody to say, hey, wait a minute, shouldn't we think this through? Maybe we shouldn't do this. Maybe, let's be a little more cautious. Let's take this step by step. Let's examine this a little more. I'm fine with all that, which is basically historically the conservative position. I think, though, when you're talking about actually taking steps that are going to cause people to suffer, are going to increase the risks or increase the numbers of suicides and homicides, that are going to increase mental illness or teenage pregnancies or sexually transmitted diseases or all the things that come along with increased inequality, I'm not sure I'd call them terrorists, but something like that. Interesting point, Gerald. Thanks for calling and sharing it. Ryan in Denver. Hey, Ryan. You have a question about Australia? Ryan? In Denver? Okay. Well, Ryan, it says here that Ryan has a question about the statistics in Australia. So I'll just share that story with you real quickly. And, Ryan, you'll have to call us back if you want to get on. Maybe your phone is muted. I can't hear you. On April 28, 1996, in Port Arthur, Tasmania. Now, Tasmania is kind of, to Australia like Hawaii is to the U.S., I guess. It's an island off the coast, right? Actually, maybe it's more even like Puerto Rico, because I think Tasmania has a certain amount of limited independence. But in any case, this guy killed 35 people. And in response, the conservative Prime Minister John Howard, this is George W. Bush's best buddy, said, okay, that's it. And here's the Dylan Matthews and Slate's Will Oremus. This was in the Washington Post. Actually, I've got the Washington Post story here too, but here's the summary. Homicides by firearm plunged 59% between 1995 and 2006. Shane, I just heard an ISDN beep. Oh, okay. Homicides by firearm plunged 59% between 1995 and 2006 with no corresponding increase in non-firearm-related homicides. In other words, fewer people died, fewer homicides. The drop in suicides by gun was even steeper, 65%. And what they found was that in those areas of Australia where the gun buyback programs were really aggressive and done really early, like in Tasmania, they were really, really, I mean, they just jumped at it. Suicides also dropped faster. And in those parts of the country where the gun buybacks were, you know, took a year or two to implement, suicides dropped more slowly. Same with homicides. So, anyhow, I just have a minute to the break, so I'm not going to, I've got a bunch of callers here. We will get to you in just a second, but it's just not enough time for that. But this is John Howard, Dylan Matthews, writing over at the Washington Post. John Howard, who served as Prime Minister of Australia from 1996 to 2007, is no one's idea of a lefty. He was one of George W. Bush's closest allies, enthusiastically backing the Iraq intervention, and took a hard line domestically against increased immigration and union organizing. But what did he do in 1996? He passed a gun control law. It banned semi-automatic and automatic rifles and shotguns. This is just it, rifles and shotguns. And guess what? Suicide went down. It's enough. It's like the entire country saying, enough. Now, when you consider that the Second Amendment was passed in large part, and if you don't believe me, read Patrick Henry and George Mason's speeches at the Virginia Ratifying Convention. You can find them online. The Second Amendment was passed to protect the institution of slavery, the slave patrols.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Because in the South, the slave patrols were called well-regulated militias. Read the Second Amendment. Maybe we should say, hey, you know, if we took out slavery, we're going to take out the Second Amendment. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. And Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Hope you're doing well. Hey,
ditto.
I just back wanted to ask kind of a basic question with the story about the older gentleman being beaten up or having a fall. Wouldn't the doctors who treated him be able to say something one way or t'other?
Yeah, they would. And apparently, and this, you know, we just have to go by the news reports. I haven't interviewed the doctors. Nobody is talking to the press other than this guy's
lawyer. The doctors aren't coming forward?
No, they're, well,
the information?
That's against the law. If your doctor came forward with information about your medical condition, he could be prosecuted or she could be prosecuted.
Not the medical condition, but the possible crime committed against a citizen.
I don't even think that a doctor can do that until they're, you know, compelled to testify in a court of law.
Well, I'm not saying they have to. I'm saying, you know, there's
well, they will, they will have to. They will be subpoenaed to testify if this thing gets to court.
So we have to have a court of law to get people to speak honestly amongst each other.
Well, you've got to get a court of law for a doctor to describe the medical condition of a person, and I'm okay with that, aren't you?
Yeah,
there are eyewitnesses to this thing. There's a bunch of eyewitnesses. They've come forward. Their testimony was published in the New York Post yesterday. You can read it online.
Well, I believe in.
And they said we watched this cop beat the crap out of this old guy. I mean, you know, I'm paraphrasing, but
yeah,
you know, it's.
Well, it sounds bad, but you know.
Yeah. So I don't think that we need to go to the doctors to and like I said, I'm sure that you know that's where it's going to end up. But were you just being contrarian, Bob, or was there a larger point there? I don't mean to say that there's anything wrong with being contrarian. That's fine, too. But
no, I wasn't trying to be contrarian. I was just the story with so much police brutality and
right.
So much going on with the power of the state and just
yeah.
All of the violent behavior on the part of states across this world right now, I think. You know, when an old guy gets beaten up and there's people that know about it, I don't know why we need to wait till the court date to start talking about what happened.
Well, we're talking about it right now. I mean, it's in the news. It was on the front page of the Washington
Post. That's why the obvious question about the doctors.
Yeah, yeah. I get what you're saying. And you know, it's interesting because, you know, we had the caller earlier saying essentially, let's do away with the Republicans. And I would think that it would be a conservative position because police are state actors, right? Police are employees of the state. They are the government, right? They are
when the government's acting on behalf of the people. When the government's now acting on behalf of corporations, we have to question to some degree.
No, I absolutely agree. But wouldn't the conservative position be that we need to regulate our police? Because
absolutely.
Because that is where government, the potential for government violence becomes actual physical violence on human beings.
Oh yeah, I think there's a need for police in society. I'm not against the police. I'm saying there needs to be legitimacy, just like I'm not against government. I think there needs to be, you know, transparency in government.
Yeah.
What's going on across our nation is not working out too well right now.
Yeah, I'm with you, Bob. It seems to me like this is a position that conservatives and liberals should agree on. Bob, thanks for the call. Good to hear from you. It is 10 minutes before the hour. We will be back in just a moment. Tom Hartman with you. I also want to get into why Ruth Bader Ginsburg opposed Roe v. Wade. And that's a really interesting conversation. I'm going to get into that in about a half hour, 20 minutes past the next hour. But I think it's fascinating that the most liberal justice on the Supreme Court makes a very good case. In fact, makes the case that I have made on this program. And I did not know until today that she was making this case, that Roe v. Wade was wrongly decided. And I'll explain what I mean and what Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who is a big supporter of abortion rights, means at 20 minutes past the next hour. So, but right now we got a bunch of calls on this topic, on these topics that we've talked about. Robin in Athens, Tennessee. Hey, Robin, what's up?
Hey, Tom. How you doing, buddy?
Good, good. What's on your mind?
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the suicide stuff you were talking about.
Mm-hmm.
I worked for a while with terminally ill children, and so depression and suicide was the topic I looked a lot into.
Right.
The most important determining factor on suicide is what they call the hope scale. As long as there's some level of hope,
right,
you're okay.
Mm-hmm.
But when the patient reaches zero hope, when they see no way out, then suicide is imminent.
Right.
That's why it's important when you talk about the economy. There is no hope. You and I both grew up thinking, I can do better than my dad, right?
Yeah, but our kids are not thinking that.
They're not thinking that.
Yeah.
How can they? I mean, they're being realistic about it.
Well, see, I think that there still is the possibility that we can roll back Reaganomics, and once again, our children can do better than their parents did, and their children can do better than they did. But it's going to take a lot of people waking up. And frankly, I think that's happening all across the country, Robin. I think the fact that...
I agree with you 1,000%. That's the way to go. And that's what I try to tell them, is there is hope coming.
Well, and here's some proof of it. When the president and Republicans tried to get a Democrat to co-sponsor this fast-track authority in the House of Representatives so that they could call it the bipartisan trade bill...
Right.
Which is, they still called it that. Bipartisan is the first word of the bill. It has no Democrat, not one. And there's some really conservative Democrats in the House of Representatives. I mean, there's some Democrats in the House of Representatives who represent red districts in red states, but they just happen to be Democrats because people, you know, in those states like them or like their policies or whatever. None of them would sponsor this fast track for the trade deal. It's like people are waking up, and it looks like they're waking up fastest in the Democratic Party, but frankly, I think that they're waking up in the Republican Party as well. People are starting to – actually, it's the independents. Independent right now is the largest percentage of Americans who vote represent themselves now as independents rather than Democrats or Republicans. And I think it's because they're saying, you know, 32 years of Reaganomics under two Democratic presidents and Democratic and legislatures as well as Republican legislatures, we're still in Reaganomics and it's still screwing us enough already. And we need to do something else. Robin, thanks for the call. That's excellent. Excellent point. Mike in McHenry, Illinois. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Guns. You know, it's not that I don't agree with you. We have a problem almost daily in the news. There's a shooting. There's a public shooting. There's someone in the United States almost daily who we would see preparing for.
More than daily, you have a child, a pre-teenager, accidentally killed by a gun. More than daily.
Right.
About 500 a year.
I'm here, Tom, though. With all due respect, I love you. You're looking at the guys of your generation, which is the prohibition, heavy-handed restrictions, wars, these types of things. And if we've learned anything from the war on drugs, is that a war on guns would be disastrous.
I disagree totally.
Likely,
I don't think that there is an innate, there is not, we are not wired to shoot guns. We did not co-evolve with guns. We co-evolved with cannabis. We have THC receptors in our brain. We co-evolved with alcohol. We have ethanol receptors in our brain.
Yeah, but the thing is, Tom, is you and I would not. But once you start to track the cultural embeddingment of some parts of the nation, they will. They don't have the access to sophistication that you and I have. And
I don't think it's a matter of sophistication, Mike.
It's a matter of sophistication because you and I would never.
It's a matter of cultural consensus. Australia was a gun crazy society until the Tasmania massacre. 35 people were killed, and Australia woke up. We would have woken up, I think, if it wasn't for the efforts of the NRA.
Right,
I think Newtown would have woken up.
Australia, that's very true. But Australia also has a myriad of social programs, and also has an entire system set up to catch people when they fall. I entirely disagree about hope and about suicide. And we are programmed to survive only in the most deleterious of situations. And the suicide in the United States, it's chemically driven. And I also believe that guns are an addiction. The people who are immersed in gun culture, guns will always be the solution to the problem. More guns will take care of the problem. They're terrified to give up these guns.
I think that's guns a small number of people, Mike. I think that's a very small number of people.
I really don't. Tom, I was raised in gun culture. I was raised by a lunatic from your generation, Turner Diaries, secede from the government, the whole thing. I think you're a little bit off on that. I disagree with you.
Well, okay. We will have to respectfully disagree. I hope that I'm right and you're wrong, Mike, but you may be right. And I'm not asserting absolute certainty on this, but, you know, I will share an opinion. Thanks a lot for the call, Mike. Ryan in Denver. Hey, Ryan.
Hello, Tom. How you doing?
Good. We got 1 minute until the end of the hour.
All right. Well, I do want to say, after doing some research, I see that the suicide rate in Australia did go down. However, the assault rate went up 200%. Armed robbery rate went up 20% just between 97 and 2002. And I think another stark...
And what you can correlate that with, rather than the lack of guns, is you can correlate that with the election of a conservative administration and the collapse of the economy.
Well, you can certainly try to make that correlation if you want to, but
I would.
When you look at the starting
John Howard
that,
went into office
there was
in 96.
No constitutional right for Australians to own guns, and before the ban, there was very limited ownership of guns. You still, before the ban, had to have reasons, had to be part of a group, so there was never the proliferation of gun ownership that there has been elsewhere.
Those gun buyback programs brought in hundreds of thousands of guns, and it has dramatically reduced both homicides and suicides. And, you know, all the other cultural ills that you talk about, like I said, you know, they elected a conservative prime minister. The government started dialing back on many of their social programs. I believe that that's the cause of those things, right? Not the lack of availability of guns. Although it's possible, you know, that more people got beat up rather than getting shot. If that's the case, I think that's a good thing. Ryan, thanks for the call.
Listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartmann.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartmann.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And what happens when the frackers come to town? Well, I think we learned that here in Washington, D.C. A year or two ago. I was on the air, in fact, when it happened, sitting here looking at the camera and talking into the microphone, and all of a sudden the room starts shaking. And I'm like, wait a minute. The last time this happened to me, I was in Los Angeles. You expect that in Los Angeles. But Washington, D.C., I mean, they finally are just taking the scaffolding down from around the Washington Monument right now, and they're taking it down a little bit by bit, and it's been closed all this time. You know, there's cracks there, there's cracks in the Capitol building. I mean, the frackers came to town. I mean, they weren't fracking here in Washington D.C., but they were fracking nearby in Virginia, and there's a lot of people who are still a little suspicious of that. Well. They came to Azle, Texas, and Alan Brundrett is with us. He's the mayor of Azle, of the city of Azle, Texas. Alan, welcome to the program. Or Mayor Brundrett? Excuse me.
Uh-huh.
Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Pardon my lack of respect there. It's,
well, Alan's good.
The office really deserves the respect. Being a mayor is no easy thing, even in a small town. Tell me about Azle, first of all, and tell us what happened.
Well, I mean, we're a small town on the outskirts of Fort Worth with about 11,000 people or so, and all of a sudden one day the ground started shaking. And they kept shaking and shaking days after days, and we've had over 30 earthquakes now since the beginning of November.
Whoa. And do you have a history of earthquakes, Nasal? I mean, the area's been presumably occupied for, by people who write English for at least 150 years.
Right, exactly. We have no history of earthquakes at all in Azle, and it's just all of a sudden, you know, not just one that started, but like I said, 30 over a course of a couple months, from 0 to 30. So, you know, if you had one, you would say, wow, that was just strange. But now when you have 30, that's
right.
Really strange.
Yeah. My understanding is here in D.C., they stopped the fracking nearby, but I could be wrong on that. But so what makes you think that it was fracking, and what did you all – I understand you and a bunch of folks in town did you go to Austin, to the state capitol, to talk about this?
I didn't make the trip to Austin, but a bunch of people did go down there to the Railroad Commission to their meeting. And, you know, as to the fracking part of it, you know, it's not actually the fracking part of it. It's the injection wastewater wells that have been time and time again linked to earthquake activity. And that is basically where they take the wastewater from the gas wells and inject it into new wells just for disposal.
So they're pumping hundreds or millions of gallons of water into the contaminated.
Exactly. Contaminated water into the earth. I mean, the one well was about 15,000 barrels a day that they were pumping, which is about 825,000 gallons a day.
Wow, that's one big bulge that it would create in the earth, you would think.
Exactly.
And these fracking fluids, I mean, if it's the waste, the whole point of fracking fluids, my understanding is that they lubricate the rocks and cause them to crack. And so it would make sense that if you're in a geologically, even slightly unstable area, lubricating the rocks would make them move more easily.
Right. There's a couple of theories. You know, I've been doing research and reading articles and all that, of course, you know, after all this. And, you know, you've got, number one, the pressure, number two, the lubrication, like you said. But you can get this pressure just built up under the ground without even lubrication part of it, and the pressure will make the fault slip.
Right. So the solution would be for the fracking companies to dispose of their wastewater in some way other than injecting it back into the ground.
Exactly, exactly. And I don't understand the thought of taking contaminated trash water and putting it into our earth to start with. But
right. You got an aquifer down there somewhere, don't you?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you know, it's a cheap way to get rid of things.
That's what it is.
So, interesting. Now, you mentioned the Railroad Commission. My recollection is, in fact, we've had a former Texas Railroad Commissioner on this program a number of times, that the Railroad Commission actually controls the oil industry in Texas. Is that right? Or regulates
exactly.
It?
Exactly. They regulate the oil and gas industry in Texas, yes.
Right. What was the response from the Railroad Commission?
You know, the good thing I can say about them is they have actually responded and not, you know, just blown us off. You know, nobody has agreed with their response to this point, but the only good thing is they have actually responded and not said, oh, we're not even bothering with you. We're pretty much forcing them to respond. I wrote a letter to the Railroad Commission shortly after they started and requested a formal investigation by the Railroad Commission. And within a week, they called me and scheduled a town hall meeting in Azle to come out. They came out and did a town hall meeting, even though they didn't provide any answers. It was kind of a waste, but I guess it's one of those things, if you want to look on the bright side, it was kind of the thought that counts.
Yeah. Well, it's
more of a PR,
it's a step. But, I mean, you know, oil and gas are big money in Texas. And, I mean, you know, Texas oilmen, right? Like George Herbert Walker Bush and George W. Bush.
Exactly.
So.
And it's needed, but it just needs to be done properly.
Yeah. I'd much rather be, you know, if we're going to be burning oil, I'd much rather be, or gas, natural gas, I'd rather be getting it out of Texas than out of Saudi Arabia, frankly. But,
exactly.
So.
Or the other thought could be to use theirs up, and once theirs is gone, then use our own.
Yeah. I suppose the problem is you're giving all this money to people that are funding,
that are attacking us, right?
Yeah, madrasas and things and doing all kinds of weird stuff. But that's a whole other thing, you know. Rather than talking international geopolitics, let's focus on the fracking. Do you have now were these earthquakes bad enough that there was any serious damage, or were they just scary?
Yeah, they're just scary. I mean, people have been talking about, you know, cracks in their brick and in walls and things like that. But it's hard to tell because in Texas we have a real clay soil here that expands and contracts a lot. So pretty much cracks in your brick in Texas are normal. So it's hard to say if it is indeed a result of the earthquakes or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But, I mean, I was in one, you know, the one at my house, and my whole house shook and my windows rattled. I didn't have any damage to my house, but I mean, it wasn't like you see on TV where you're sitting there shaking. It was a jolt, and it sounded more like an explosion. It had an audible boom to it.
Yeah. This is not a good thing for people with PTSD. Also,
right? Exactly.
And I don't mean to laugh about it. It's just, I mean, this is there are all kinds of bad things can come out of that, and people
That's
feel.
What I thought it was. I thought it was an explosion, and I was like, wait a second, no, that was an earthquake.
Yeah. Yeah, and we're not supposed to have earthquakes here. Do you know who's doing the local fracking, what company it is?
There's a couple of them. You know, I just got some new information today, which was, I've never heard it before, that the Railroad Commission just shut down one of the wells because it was operating outside of its permitted, you know, amounts,
right,
their pressures and such. And we just now heard about that actually as a result of the meeting yesterday.
How long has it been since you've had an earthquake?
About a week ago we had one, but they've been a lot less here in the last, say, 3 weeks. We've had a lot of less earthquakes.
Yeah.
And it's funny is because now they said that they just shut down a well, and it doesn't say exactly when, but it seems like it was sometime early January.
Right.
Huh. And that one was operated by Finley Resources, it says.
Yeah. Well, there's lots of these frackers around.
Right.
Fascinating. Well, thank you for you know, sharing the story with us. And any sense of where this is going to go?
I don't know. I mean, it's getting national attention now. So the Rachel Maddow show actually just called me today and wants me to go on their show tomorrow.
Cool.
So it's not going away kind of thing.
Yeah.
Know, so they have to take notice.
That is a good thing. Alan Brundrett, the mayor of the city of Azle, Texas. Cityofazle.org is the website. And Mayor Brundrett, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I appreciate your sharing the story with us. We'll be right back. It's 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So, do we stop fracking? How about we stop using fossil fuels altogether? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Vi in Doniphan, Missouri. Hey, Vi, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. A comment about police brutality.
Mm-hmm.
I think the cops are getting a lot of their equipment from the leftovers from the Army, let's say, or the Navy or whatever.
You're right, from the military.
And I think this is part of Eisenhower warning us about the industrial-military complex issues.
Yes, I think you're right. And they're, first it was hand-downs, it was hand-me-downs, and now they're actually getting budgets to buy brand-new stuff from these defense contractors, and these defense contractors hold trade shows, and they market directly to police departments, and they've got traveling salespeople who go around to police departments all around the country and say, look at this, we got this new stun gun, or look at this, we got this new truck that shoots giant sonic waves, or look at this, we got these new Mutant Ninja Turtle vests, and the local police go, whoa, that's really cool. You know, we got to get an appropriation for that. And it goes on and on from there. So I think you're right, Vi. Vi, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Tom, watching Free Speech TV in Battle Lake, Minnesota. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
A few weeks ago, I saw a short segment on your program where you suggested that anything over $1 billion should be taxed at 100%.
Yes, sir. No more billionaires.
I think that the vast majority of the American people don't understand what $1 billion is. It's 1,000 million.
Yes, or
so
one.
Based on that, the Koch brothers, listed in Forbes at the end of 2013, were each worth $62 billion. They're each worth 62,000 million.
Right.
And another comparison is the Cargill Company. Cargill Company, their annual revenues for 2013 was $134 billion. That's revenues.
Yeah.
And I think we can do more to explain to the American people just how vast this income inequality is.
Yeah, yeah. $1 billion is a mind-boggling amount of money, and it is amazing how concentrated this wealth has become, and how basically, we've got these billionaires using. I mean, if you've got $62,000 million, and you spend a few $1,000,000 or a few $100 million on politics, you can make more billions of dollars, right? You can make more hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars, or thousands of millions of dollars. It's like ultimately it becomes that politics is your very best investment. I mean, arguably the Koch brothers' investments, which have been a small piece of their fortune, have prevented their taxes from going up over the last who knows how long they've been doing this, you know, 20, 30 years. And, you know, ever since Reagan rolled back the top tax rates. And so you could argue that they're not just political activists, that they're actually making investments. And, you know, is that any way to run a country? I don't think so. Tom, thanks a lot for the call. You're absolutely right. Most people don't realize how big $1 billion is. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. Past the hour. Welcome back, Tom Hartman, with you. And Hank in Fort Morgan, Colorado, you called back. Your phone working?
It is this time, I sure hope.
Okay, sounds good. What's up, Hank?
All right. Well, I wanted to kind of pull together a few of the stories you're talking about today. Number one, that balance of power. Two, police brutality. And three, the gun controls.
Right.
And
then I'm going to get to abortion.
Right. Well, I'm going to stay off that one. But anyway, my background, is in criminal justice. One of the things that came up during my education, during ethics, was the thought of balance of power. And one of the things that does help to balance power is the possession of firearms.
I know
a lot of people are going to, going to back me off on that one, but I'll give you a very good point. Take a state trooper who's sitting on the side of the highway who is alone versus a police officer in town. How many times do you hear of atrocities done by a single state trooper? You don't hear about it, but you do about multiple groups of police officers.
David Koresh had hundreds of firearms. Did that help him?
No, it did not. However, but please listen to me all the way through. The state trooper on the side of the road, his balance of power is, I need to make sure that I treat this person respectfully and honor what they do normally. And they don't get that power trip of, I can do whatever I want because I got 10 people who can back me up
now. Hank, I think it's the exact opposite of what you're suggesting. If a police officer has even the faintest whiff that you might have a gun and you might use it on him, he is going to come at you in a way that will be completely different than if he's certain you're just a little old lady out on a Sunday drive.
Explain to me this then. Here in Colorado, why did the sheriff's departments all fight the gun control here in Colorado?
I don't know. Typically, police departments are in favor of gun control. It may, and I doubt that all the sheriff's departments did, but probably has to do with
state?
I would bet you, Hank, that your sheriffs in Colorado are elected, and if they're elected, that means that rather than taking the positions that professional police typically take, they take the positions of the taxpayers, of the voters.
Okay, I'm going to raise this to another level. Have you done any research, and I'm asking you to do this, because you have far more resources than I do, of course, on how much more abuse of power happens in Chicago and New York, where there is high gun control, versus cities, say, such as Dallas, or even here in Denver?
But by abuse of power, what do you mean? Are you talking about police violence against people?
Police violence against citizens. So
I doubt that they're different. I would bet that your police violence rates in Dallas are probably the same as Chicago.
No. According to what we had gotten while I was in school, that was not the case. And unfortunately, I don't have the data in front of me, but I was educated to believe the opposite.
But there's probably more guns in Chicago than there are in Dallas.
In Dallas? No.
Yeah.
No, I seriously doubt that.
There's a lot more gun homicides in Chicago than there are in Dallas.
That doesn't mean there's more guns. I can guarantee you there's not more in Dallas. I'm originally from Texas. Most of my family lives in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. I can guarantee you Chicago does not have more guns than Dallas.
I suspect they do. They're just not distributed the same way. I have not done that research, Hank, and neither of you. So we're just arguing speculation.
Well, you have failed to convince me so far.
Okay.
One last question for you. One last thing. If we cannot stop the illegal flow of drugs out of Mexico into our country, which differs us from Australia, the topic that you like to back up on, they're an island state. They don't have another state right on us. If we can't stop the flow of illegal drugs, if we disarm the United States, what would happen? There would be, and if you think for a second that these major crime syndicates would not see that.
Well, Australia has a major problem with drugs being brought into that country. I mean, they're typically brought in either by boat or by airplane, but they have a major problem with drugs being smuggled into Australia.
Yeah, but not to the degree that the United States does.
The answer to that is to decriminalize drugs and treat it as a medical problem rather than a criminal justice problem.
There is always going to be a criminal element, and you have to weigh the difference. Do we want our citizens the capability to protect?
Well, you could say there's always going to be the criminal element, but what we know from looking at civilized societies is that those countries that are more egalitarian, that have a larger middle class, that have fewer poor people and fewer extremely rich people, have much lower rates of crime. And that countries that have large amounts of poverty have really high rates of crime. And we've seen these exact same trends in the United States historically. It has nothing to do with gun possession or ownership.
I would not disagree with you on that.
It's economics. It's not guns.
Story talking about the unbalance of power that we have currently. So what happens in this unequal balance of power currently?
I think you throw guns into an unequal society, and it's like pouring gasoline on a fire. You're making things worse.
or taking them away can do just the same.
I don't think so.
What we need to worry about.
I think what you'll see is what that caller earlier called about. You'll have more people beating people up instead of shooting them. Gun deaths go down, and you know, people get in fist fights instead of shootouts. That's a good thing, I think.
Not necessarily. Go back to Nazi Germany. Disarm people, what happened?
Hitler never disarmed people.
Well, what?
Hitler actually was promoting gun culture. They had, you know, they were very macho, and they had a lot of guns. There were guns all over Germany.
Not in the private hands of citizens.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely.
No.
There may not have been in Poland, in the Jewish ghetto, after Poland was invaded by Russia in Warsaw, although there were some weapons there. I mean, you know, there was a substantial uprising. But, you know, across Germany, no, there were a lot of guns in private hands. That's my point. If you're suggesting that having guns in your home are going to protect you from the state when the state goes nuts, there is no evidence that that has ever worked.
American Revolution.
Well, we were occupied. That was not an indigenous state. That was not, you know, that was Britain occupying us. That's a very, very different thing. I would say the Civil War is the example, if you want an example, and it didn't work. Anyhow, Hank, thanks for the call. Thanks for the conversation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
There's a very different thing from overthrowing an existing government that is right there in your land, as opposed to overthrowing one that's occupying your land, which is what Iraq is trying to do to us, for example. The bad and the very, very trelatitiously ugly, brought to you by the Organic Wine Company, ecowine.com. The good, the anti-Guantanamo generals. On Tuesday, 31 retired American generals sent a letter to President Barack Obama urging him to fulfill his promise to close down the Guantanamo Bay prison complex. The group, which included a former Air Force chief of staff and the head of the military's Middle East Central Command, said that, quote, Guantanamo does not serve America's interests. As long as it remains open, Guantanamo will undermine America's security and status as a nation where human rights and the rule of law matter. End quote. I couldn't have said it myself better. But the failure to close it isn't President Obama's fault. Republicans in Congress have blocked every attempt to transfer detainees out of the prison or otherwise close the complex. Regardless of whose fault it is, though, it's encouraging to see people in the military call out Guantanamo for what it is, a national embarrassment and a threat to our most basic values brought to us by George Bush and Dick Cheney. The bad, Suzanne Atanas, a Republican Illinois congressional candidate, is under fire today for comments she made to the Chicago Daily Herald about God punishing Americans for their so-called sinful lifestyle. She told the Daily Herald that she believes God controls the weather and has put tornadoes and diseases such as autism and dementia on Earth as punishment for gay rights and legalized abortions. Right. You want to know the saddest part of all? With views like that, Suzanne Atanas could probably be in the more moderate wing of the House Tea Party caucus. And the very, very ugly Gordon Denlinger. While everyone else was busy celebrating Martin Luther King Day on Monday, the Pennsylvania state representative was busy proposing his so-called Freedom of Conscience Amendment. If passed, the amendment would amend Article 1 of Pennsylvania's state constitution so that the government could not punish, quote, an individual or entity if the individual or entity makes hiring or other employment decisions or provides services, accommodations, including housing accommodations, advantages, facilities, goods, or privileges based on sincerely held beliefs, end quote. That's right. Representative Denlinger's Freedom of Conscience Amendment would legalize discrimination as long as the person doing the discriminating does so according to sincerely held beliefs, whatever that means. Proposing an amendment like that is terrible enough on a regular day, but the fact that Representative Denlinger did that on Martin Luther King Day, that is very, very ugly. Okay, I promised you this riff on abortion in the Supreme Court. I am going to do it right now. And I gotta tell you, do you know the Rand Paul right now? Do you know who the Republican frontrunner is, according to the polls? It was Chris Christie. He's been knocked out. It's Rand Paul. Rand Paul, who is in favor of gay marriage, who's in favor of decriminalizing all drugs, who's opposed to our involvement in Afghanistan, Iraq, or any foreign wars, basically. I mean, this is... who's opposed to the NSA surveillance? This guy has, he's the Republican frontrunner. And frankly, I think that with those positions, although, you know, he could give a Democrat the run for their money, except for the fact that he's also opposed to Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid and unemployment insurance. And I mean, you know, at least he's relatively consistent in his libertarianism. But anyhow, Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that Roe v. Wade, her problem with Roe v. Wade, she has two. And I agree with both points. Her first one is that Roe v. Wade does not say that a woman has a right to choose an abortion. Roe v. Wade says that a doctor has the right to choose to perform an abortion. The right of privacy, the Fourth Amendment right of privacy that was used to decide Roe v. Wade, was used based on the confidentiality of the doctor-patient relationship from the doctor's point of view. In fact, in Roe v. Wade, the doctors are referred to as hims. A bunch of men on the Supreme Court decided that male doctors should have the privacy right to provide females with abortions. Okay, number one. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg says, and I agree with her, that really this should be under the Equal Protection Clause. Men have the right to decide whether or not to procreate. They can use birth control. Women should have that same right. And at some point, abortion ceases to become birth control and starts to become murder, literally. And it's up to, and this gets us to the second point. I mean, if the clear, obvious difference is, you know, if you use a like one of the birth control pills that causes an egg that has been fertilized but in the fallopian tubes but has not implanted in the uterus to be discharged as a normal menstrual period. There are a lot of people in the anti-abortion movement who consider that abortion. This is basically, you know, hormone birth control. Right? If you put that on one end of the spectrum, and on the other end of the spectrum you say, okay, there's an abortion being done a week before birth, when you know that that baby is going to be viable. Okay, so there's obviously a spectrum in here. And there should be lines drawn somewhere in that spectrum. And I don't think any reasonable person would disagree with that. But the question is, who should draw the line? Ruth Bader Ginsburg points out that by the Supreme Court making this decision, she said, and this is Shahil Kapoor is quoting her over at TPM. He said that Ginsburg also said that the ruling damaged the growing movement for abortion rights, which was in 1973 a growing movement. Damaged that movement by going too far too fast and catalyzed the anti-abortion movement. See, had this been done by the legislative process, it might have taken another few years. In fact, it certainly would have. But there would have been a national debate, and there would have been a national consensus, and the issue would have been put to rest. But because the Supreme Court did it, there was no national debate, there was no national consensus, and the issue is still being fought. And this is why, in fact, this is what she says. She says, "That was my concern, that the court had given opponents of access to abortion a target to aim at relentlessly. My criticism of Roe is that it seemed to have stopped the momentum that was on the side of change." And that was changing the anti-abortion laws in 1973. Roe v. Wade overturned them. And I think that what she's pointing out, in the largest sense, is judicial supremacy. Is that the idea that the judiciary, 9 unelected, lifetime-serving men and women, can strike down laws passed by the people and signed by the president, or can create doctrines from whole cloth that never existed before, doctrines like money being protected by the First Amendment, I don't see the word money in the First Amendment. Or corporations being protected by the 14th Amendment. I don't see corporations in the 14th Amendment. That the Supreme Court can just come up with this stuff and then it becomes the law of the land, whether legislators like it or not, is crazy. It is not what the founders had in mind. When Marbury versus Madison was decided in 1803, when this was the first case of judicial review and judicial supremacy, where the Supreme Court said, okay, we're going to make a decision based on our interpretation of the Constitution. That's the judicial review. And they could have just stopped there. They could have said, you know, we decide in favor of Madison. Marbury doesn't get to be a judge, in our opinion. And then leave it up to the executive branch whether or not they're going to follow that opinion. But then they went a step beyond that and said, therefore, you must. And the executive branch deferred to that. And I can tell you, I'm there's no doubt in my mind that Jefferson really battled with that, because there were other times the executive branch didn't. In the Cherokee, the Trail of Tears case, the Supreme Court told Andrew Jackson, President Andrew Jackson, you may not move those Indians from Georgia to Oklahoma. And he said, Justice Marshall has made his decision, let him enforce it. And he called out the army and he moved the Indians. Now, you know, history says that, tells us that probably Justice Marshall was more, you know, certainly more humane than President Andrew Jackson. Might have been right, but nonetheless, the Supreme Court should not be taking these extreme steps. Now they're preparing to strike down laws passed by Congress and signed by a president, in this case FDR, and subsequent laws that make it legal for there to be unions in the public sector among government employees. They're going to strike that down. Mark my words. By this fall, if they don't strike it down, they're going to dig a big hole in it. They're going to punch holes in it so big, just like, you know, with Citizens United. They said, oh, well, you know, Congress can pass a law mandating transparency. They just can't control the money. Right. Congress is going to pass that law, you think? And the same thing that they just did with the right to vote. They stripped out parts of the Voting Rights Act and said, well, even though it was decided 99-0 in the Senate, in fact, this was the rationale that Scalia used. He said, well, obviously it was 99-0 in the Senate, not because it was the right thing to do, but because these senators were terrified. And therefore, we have to rely on Antonin Scalia to save us. Really?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We have ceased to be a constitutionally limited representative democracy, and we have started to be a constitutional monarchy, with the Supreme Court as the monarchs. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and John in Packwood, Washington. Hey, John, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Belated Happy New Year to you.
Happy New Year to you, too, John.
I heard a really disturbing report on RTTV about a week ago concerning a new twist to this corrupted business of fracking.
Mm-hmm.
Came out of Wyoming, apparently, although I tried to confirm it, but I couldn't get all the details, so you might want to look into this further. But essentially, what's been happening is they create a corporation for the specific purpose of performing the actual fracking and drilling operations.
Right.
And what's been happening is they've been abusing the corporate form again, and they're deliberately basically avoiding paying the remediation costs of the basically exhausted fracking wells as they are rapidly exhausted.
Oh, in other words, they create a corporation, they frack, and now there's a bunch of waste and a bunch of stuff that needs to be cleaned up, and they bankrupt the corporation.
Right. Yeah. And the more disturbing than that is apparently from the broadcast on RT, they had documentation that goes back to the raising of funds, the investors, to set up the corporation and get the money. And apparently these letters state that this is part of their plan.
Well, this is what Freedom Industries just did in West Virginia.
Well, I know, but this, like I said, was disturbing. Now, I tried to check the Wyoming legislature to see if there was any pending bills I could find. So I'm not sure if it's a state bill or a national bill. But it looks like this is going to be part of their plan to, you know, basically foster these costs onto the public at large, because apparently the senator had 40 wells on his property, and he's trying to get, you know, the governing bodies, the public, to pay for the cost to remediate the land.
Wow.
And I'll just leave it there and let you, you know, what you got to say about that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, this is the American business model, tragically. Internalize the profits, externalize the liabilities, the costs. And it's wrong. It's not a good thing. Carl in Los Angeles watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Carl, what's up?
Hello, Tom. This is Carl from Eagle Rock, Los Angeles. Bless you. God bless you.
Thank you.
The first thing is I'd like to say is we have to start calling it our government, my representative, not the leaders of our party, the representatives.
Right.
When they talk about the government becoming too big, they're speaking about the people becoming too powerful. So they just want to limit our powers, and we should stop reelecting the same people. I mean, I have a representative been there probably about since 1980, and I disagree with them more and more every day, and I call them about TPP and things like that.
Yeah.
Don't get.
Who would that be? Who represents you?
Javier Becerra. And
okay.
A couple of times he would, you know, send me letters saying, hey, I agree with you. This is what I sent the president. The other times they don't even call back until, you know, I ask him what his point of view is on TPP, and they've been waiting 3 weeks.
Wow.
The next thing is we should stop the revolving door. Ross Perot had it right where, you know, if you leave a position in the government, you cannot lobby that position or the areas in which you work. You can't lobby that for 5 years. I think that is awesome. I think that would be great. You can become a lobbyist, but you have to be a lobbyist for doing something else or in some other area, which is, you know, their thing. I think we can clean out the government really quick if
yeah.
we pass a law like that.
Yeah, I agree. And we used to have anti-revolving door laws, and I don't know if it's that the legislatures did away with them. I don't think the Supreme Court struck any of them down, but arguably say what? It's still 2 years. Oh, there's still a 2-year prohibition on lobbying. Interesting. Okay. Carl, let's make it 20. Carl, thanks a lot for the call. Good one. Helen Ratner's up next with the Talk Radio News Service, and brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, your media support group for We the People. Let's check in with Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Ellen's charity based out of South Sudan, where you can give the gift of a goat to a returning slave in South Sudan and get a picture of your goat in the recipient. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi, Tom. What can I say? Today started the Geneva 2 conference for Syria. And interestingly enough, of course, the opposition side came in and say they want a removal of Assad. Assad's people came in and said they wanted to keep Assad. Secretary of State John McCain said that he thinks Assad...
You mean John Kerry?
Did I say, yes, John Kerry. Sorry. Should
okay.
be removed from power. But it's interesting that the Syrian foreign minister... kept going past 30 minutes. He and the Secretary General of the United Nations, Ban Ki-moon, had a pretty nasty, not nice exchange. It's on YouTube and everywhere else. And this was a 30-minute diatribe. And then when Ban Ki-moon tried to stop him, he said, "You live in New York. I live in Syria."
Right.
I shouldn't laugh about it. It's horrible.
I mean, it could be that what he's saying is, you live in New York and I live in a country where if I don't do this, I will be executed.
Well, that's also probably true. Yes, that's a very interesting point.
Yeah.
But if I were him, I wouldn't go back. But hey,
yeah.
Who am I?
Yeah.
So I think that that the Syrian thing is probably going to come no more. And speaking of these kinds of talks, the talks in Addis Ababa on South Sudan are not continuing. And now I just got an email from one of my guys that rebels are taking, which is the other party, basically taking over another town. For instance, the town of Bor, which is where the oil is, goes back and forth and back and forth. And one day one holds it and one day another holds it.
Yeah. Well, of course, it's where the oil is. This is, you know, oil has always been a curse in the third world. Arguably in the first world, too. It's destroying our planet.
Right. So that is what's going on at the Geneva II conference. Of course, this is the same time that we're seeing Davos happen, also in Switzerland.
Right, and Davos basically the world's billionaires getting together and partying.
That's right, and I mean you've seen the wealth things come out about that. It's just staggering.
Yeah, it truly is.
Okay, the debt ceiling. Well, Congress is out of session this week, but the debt ceiling is still happening, and it looks like it will. Congress needs to raise it by the end of February. They said that it needs to be raised before February 7th. This is Jack Lew, who is the Treasury Secretary, so that orderly financial arrangements can take place, and we're not going to be going and spooking the markets and all that kind of stuff. But, of course, Congress is out of session this week, so we have no idea whether this is going to happen or not.
Well, just because they're on vacation doesn't mean that, you know, various members of Congress don't step up to the microphone. Is there any babbling in the background, you know?
No babbling so far. I mean, he just really came out with this. I'm sure we're going to hear a whole lot from Boehner and the Tea Party folks, not that I want to put them in the same category, but
right.
about government spending and all of that kind of issue.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, today, March for the Living was on the mall today, and it was very interesting. Tomorrow, you and I are going to be at Families USA at the Hyatt in Washington. Well, today the place was filled with all the March for Life people.
This is the anti-abortion group.
This is the anti-abortion group. Well, you know, I have a hard time keeping my mouth shut, and I really tried to walk by them, but then I was stuck in the line in the bathroom. What was I going to say?
Uh-oh. Ellen got in trouble.
Ellen got in trouble. I could not control myself. But they are out in full force. And you know what's so unbelievable is they really do believe they're going to turn back the clock.
Well, I think they may. I mean, this is Ruth Bader Ginsburg just came out and said, and I think she's right, that the Supreme Court sticking their nose into Roe v. Wade, first of all, they decided it based on the doctor's right to privacy, not the woman's. And so she felt that it should have been the 14th Amendment. It should have been a woman's right to have equal protection under the law, same as men, to decide whether or not
right.
to have a baby.
She believes that it was done on the wrong basis.
That's right. And I agree with her. But she also believes that because the Supreme Court took this case on and basically struck down the law, rather than waiting for legislatures, that the pro-abortion movement, which was growing at that time, it was part of the, you know, it was woof and weave with the feminist movement, with the women's movement in that day, in the early 70s. We're both old enough to remember that movement just went away because everybody said, okay, Roe v. Wade, cool. But the anti-abortion movement not only didn't go away, they got super energized. And had it gone through a legislative process and had we had, you know, a national debate
right,
about
right.
this.
Right, they wouldn't have been, in the same way, in some respects, how gay marriage has been in many places.
Yeah, I don't disagree, at least in those states where it's struck down judicially rather than legislatively.
Okay, the president today actually signed an executive order or a memorandum, actually, which is kind of like an executive order, about putting together something to reduce rape and assault in colleges. They say about 1 in 5 women is a survivor of an attempted or completed sexual violence while in college.
Wow. Going to college is dangerous for women.
That's right, and that's very, very scary. So he's tried to put together a very high-level group of people to see what they can do in terms of Secretary of Education. Now, what we know is they often use student loan funds, that kind of thing, to force an institution to begin to put more security, et cetera, saying, you know, we're not going to certify you to get student loans. So if you don't do that at a college, your college is gone.
Right.
So they do have a carrot. They do have a stick.
Yeah, it's like the highway funds thing with the states.
Exactly.
Yeah.
This from the state of Virginia, they voted in the House of Delegates. Of course, it's not going to get signed by Governor Terry McAuliffe, but they want to bring back the lecture chair. Now, the Death Penalty Information Center says that this is a way of getting them to get injection drugs much more quickly because some of them, you know, have run out or expired,
right.
et cetera.
Well, the companies are refusing to make them.
That's right.
Is what's going on. I mean, these companies are saying, no, we're not going to make them. drugs that will help you. Alan Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Go to theoldgoat.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, by the way. A Republican candidate, let me just first recap just the last couple of hours. We've talked at some length about how Ruth Bader Ginsburg is criticizing Roe v. Wade, the decision, 1973 decision that struck down the abortion laws across the country as unconstitutional. For two reasons. One, because it was done based on the Fourth Amendment right of privacy of the doctor. And the assumption in the ruling was that the doctors were men to perform medicine the way that they chose and to enter into a private relationship with their patients. Okay. So the right of privacy of the doctor-patient relationship. That was the base. That was a basis of Roe v. Wade. And Ruth Bader Ginsburg says, you know, shouldn't have been the Fourth Amendment right of doctors. It should have been the 14th Amendment right of equal protection of women to have an equal say over, you know, reproductive outcomes to men. So it should have been a 14th Amendment case, number one. But number two, and I think that this is a more cogent and important distinction and criticism, is that Ruth Bader Ginsburg made the point that because that in 1973, we were just a few years into a really big women's movement in the United States. I mean, you could argue that it kicked off in 1961 when the birth control pill was introduced to the marketplace, and suddenly women had a lot of control over their reproductive system. And that arguably kicked off the, quote, sexual revolution of the 60s, but it also kicked off the women's movement. And then women could say, okay, I'm not going to have babies, or I'm not going to have babies until I'm 30 or 40 or whatever. I'm going to be, you know, a success in the workplace, or I'm going to be, you know, I'm going to be married or not, but whatever. Women had the choices, the ability, once the birth control was legalized, or not legalized, brought to the marketplace, 1961, I think it was, women had this ability to basically compete with men in the workforce. Now, they're still only earning $73 for every $100 a man earns, but that happened. And Ms. Magazine came out, as I recall, in the late 60s, early 70s, I think it was 71, 72. You had... I am not an expert on and don't want to represent myself as an expert on the women's movement, but I was alive during that time and I remember it quite well. And there was a huge movement within the women's movement and a lot of men supportive of it to decriminalize abortion. And I remember back in the 60s when I was in high school, that if a girl got pregnant, she would go to the hospital and have what was called a DNC back then, which I think is dilation and something that starts with a C. But basically, they open up the uterus and scrape out the inside of it. And for some reason, there was this epidemic prior to 1973 of young women who had super thick uterine linings. And they had to have this procedure done to correct problems that had to do with menstruation and things. And then all of a sudden, after 1973, when abortions got legalized, I mean, how many DNCs have you heard of anybody having? I mean, literally, you know, when I was, it was a fairly common thing. I knew several girls who had DNCs, and I didn't know at the time that that was code for abortion. But apparently it was. So abortions were happening. We were just calling them something else. These would be very early term abortions. These would be first, second, third month, first trimester abortions. It was happening. And secondly, there was the decriminalized abortion movement was growing as part of and one of the animating factors in the women's movement. And by the Supreme Court stepping in 1973 and saying, okay, abortion is decriminalized nationwide, period, end of discussion. It short-circuited that conversation. That anti-abortion or that pro-abortion movement basically died. There was no need for it any longer. But the anti-abortion movement that was also arising in response to the pro-abortion movement that was reactive not only continued to grow but got a giant shot in the arm, a giant shot of adrenaline. By virtue of the fact that abortion had been decriminalized by the Supreme Court. And I agree with Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and I would say that, you know, you could make an argument that there has really been no time in American history. Now, people will say, what about Brown v. Board in 1954? And I would say, you know, I don't think Brown v. Board led to the civil rights movement. I think the civil rights movement came out of the integration of the military in World War II. And not the civil rights movement, but the end of apartheid in the United States, basically, in part. And it came in part out of the rise of the American middle class, including the beginnings of a black middle class in the United States. It's just these things are evolutionary. They're generational. And for a decade or more, you had the right wingers, you know, with these impeach Earl Warren signs. And they were all angry. I mean, the whole John Birch Society thing, it was all about, you know, we hate Earl Warren. Why do you hate Earl Warren? Well, Earl Warren was the Chief Justice who wrote Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, which said you can't have separate but equal schools. You have to integrate your schools. And this was, you know, arguably a very good thing. The court was recognizing, you know, something that was going on that had already been done in some northern states or in some communities. But I think that if you look back at the history of judicial supremacy, if you look back at the history of when the court said, okay, we're going to solve the problem, whether it was Plessy v. Ferguson in 1898, where the court said, oh, yeah, well, you know, after Reconstruction, we got this mess. You know, we've got, you know, states that are trying to prevent African-Americans from voting. And you've got and yet at the same time, and they people, these freed slaves, I mean, literally, there were freed slaves at that time, want equal rights or the children of freed slaves. We'll solve that problem by creating apartheid in the United States. Now, it wasn't quite as grinding and brutal as apartheid in South Africa, which was really more of a slave state, but it was damn bad. And this was the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in 1856 with Dred Scott versus Sanford, where they said that people are property. Sure enough, slavery is fine. It's in the Constitution. People are private property. And that led to the Civil War. And then the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. If you look at the history of judicial review, maybe they got it right a few times. But more often than not, I would submit to you that the times when they got it right, it still would have been better if it had gone through the legislative process and there had been a national discussion about it. If it had originated from the people themselves. If, for example, Colorado, If the Supreme Court of Colorado had struck down Colorado's marijuana laws and said, that's it, marijuana is now legal in Colorado, here is a scheme for regulating it, here's how it's going to work, like they did in Roe v. Wade. You know, here, you got three trimesters, and we're going to set up different rules for each one. I'll bet you there would be a huge movement right now to recriminalize pot by amending the Constitution of Colorado. People don't like judges saying, here's what if. We really need to reconsider judicial review in the United States. Anyhow, there's that. But what I really, and then we had a debate about gun control in the very beginning. But what I really want to get into is Rand Paul, the 2016 election, and what this is going to do for Democrats and progressives.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a really fascinating dynamic happening in the Republican Party right now. Peter Beinart is writing about it over at The Atlantic. I'll tell you about that in about 5 minutes. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Mr. Cam in New Rochelle, New York, listening on WBAI. How are you today?
Yes, good evening, sir. I wanted to take issue with something you said last time, I believe, about Eisenhower and the military-industrial complex. You sort of believe that he was really kind of against the military-industrial complex.
No, I don't. I think he helped grow it, and he rationalized it in his speech. He said, you know, prior to the last war, we had no separate armaments industry. But now I'm paraphrasing now, but that was his exact phrase. But to paraphrase, he said, basically the Cold War, the rise of the Soviet Soviet Union has necessitated a creation of a military industrial complex. And then he went on to say in the Council's government, we must be very careful about the influence of this, whether sought or unsought. So he was a cheerleader for the military industrial complex, and he helped make it happen. He was just saying to us, look out, guys.
Okay, that sounds a lot better. But the point, well, there are two responses I want to make. First of all, he overthrew every democracy he could get his hands on in the name of anti-communism and spreading democracy.
Yeah, especially in South America.
Right, he did it in South America. The Arbenz business there in Guatemala.
Yeah.
Also in Iran. The first elected man they had, Mossadegh, and in order to take over their oil.
Yeah, and that was a huge mistake. I mean, look at the blowback from that. We're still dealing with the blowback from that. You're right.
Exactly. So here we are in this enormous mess, and just the modus operandi here should be that everything we hear from Republicans, they are doing or planning to do the opposite.
Well, you could say that of some Democrats, too. I'm sorry. It's just, I think that's the nature of, I don't mean to make light of it, but, you know, I don't get how Democrats, you know, like President Obama or Bill Clinton can say, we're gonna, you know, help manufacturing here in the United States and improve the job situation by entering into a free trade deal with foreign countries that have lower wages and no environmental standards.
Okay, maybe, but I think that's incompetence as much as anything else.
May well be. It may well, but I think you could say back in the 90s that it was incompetence on the part of Bill Clinton because we hadn't really done it and we didn't know. But now we've done it and we know. I don't think it's incompetence on the part of President Obama.
Okay. I don't want to come out being, you know, allowing you to be even-handed here.
okay.
Yeah, that's not appropriate. First of all, it's really the minimum wage, which is like $23 or $25 in European countries. This is what's killing the working class.
Yeah, it's $16 in Australia. I mean, it should be if it had kept up with productivity, the minimum wage would be $17 in the United States right now.
Right.
If it had kept up with inflation, it would be $10.10. If it had kept up with productivity, it would be $17. I mean, you know, which is what it is in most of the rest of the developed world, roughly.
Okay. So the point is Republicans are stopping that. Democrats are trying to do it whenever they can, but they haven't been able to do it this time, of course, because of this depression that was created by Republicans. But it,
to a large extent.
Okay. I was just trying to think if there's anything more to say about... Well, Churchill said that Eisenhower should talk to the Russians to try to work out some kind of agreement on the nuclear weapons. And Eisenhower refused to do it.
Yeah, well, Churchill was right. Mr. Cam, thank you for the call, and thank you for listening to WBAI. We'll be back. It's the place where despair is not an option, the Tom Hartman Program. To paraphrase Bernie Sanders, a phrase I stole from him years ago. He said, cool, go for it. Okay, I got Peter Beinhart, who I have tremendous respect for as a political observer and a progressive commentator, has a new piece in The Atlantic that is apparently just out because I got a promotional email from the PR person over at The Atlantic about this saying, hey, you ought to check, you know, have this guy on as a guest or something. But and Peter's been on as a guest in the past, but I just want to riff on this a little bit because here's Peter's take on this, basically. And as I said, you can read this at The Atlantic. Is that the polls show or politics indicate that Rand, now that Chris Christie has been knocked out of the number one spot in the Republican Party, that it's going to be Rand Paul, and that this could might be like 64, where the dark horse, weird, fringe, ultra-conservative candidate, Barry Goldwater, became the party's nominee. And Rand Paul, and he says the reason for this, in large part, in addition to the fact that he's got good, you know, polling numbers, is that his dad, well, he makes the point that the Republican Party, with the exception of George W. Bush, and arguably, well, I'll give you the arguable in just a second, the Republican Party never nominates somebody to be their candidate who hasn't run 4 years earlier in the primary. The exception being George W. Bush. But George W. Bush, actually, his dad had been president, so his, you know, there was an existing infrastructure for the Bushes. And he says the exact same thing is true of Rand Paul, that basically there's this existing infrastructure within the Republican Party where Ron Paul took, you know, big, I mean, you know, I think when all was said and done and you look back on it, he actually won Iowa and they had jerry-rigged it so he didn't. And came in second in New Hampshire right behind Mitt Romney, who lived in the state next door. That Ron Paul was a strong contender in the Republican Party. Rand Paul has that those people have not gone away, those Ron Paul followers. They are now Rand Paul followers. And they are embedded inside the Republican Party. And so the essence of Peter Beinhart's piece in The Atlantic is that, you know, Rand Paul has a very good shot of becoming the Republican nominee in 2016 for president. And isn't that interesting? I'd like to take it a step beyond that. Rand Paul hates Social Security, thinks Social Security should be handed over to the billionaires on Wall Street, should be totally privatized. Hates Medicare. Medicare should be given to the big insurance companies, give it to billionaires like Stephen Jay Hemsley, and, you know, let them run it. Let them make everything the government does except its military and police functions and its judiciary should be turned over to somebody who can make a buck off it. Now, most people don't know that that's Rand Paul's position on pretty much everything. Figure out some way somebody can make a buck off it. But what they do know is that he is opposed to the NSA spying on us. He is opposed to laws that I believe he is opposed to laws that prevent gays from getting married. Actually, I'm not sure on that. Yeah, gay marriage. He's in favor of gay marriage. He is opposed to laws that, or he's in favor of decriminalizing drugs, all drugs. So when you look at things like, you know, the NSA or drugs or gay marriage, Rand Paul is to the left of the official Democratic Party, or at least much of the official Democratic Party. Now, you could argue that Barry Goldwater was taking some of these same positions back in 64 when he ran, but nobody really knew about that. Goldwater famously said, you don't have to be straight to shoot straight. He was in favor of gays serving openly in the military. This was in 1964, when being gay was still listed in the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of the American Psychiatric Association as a mental illness. I mean, how much times have changed? And yet Barry Goldwater, you know, was holding some of these very kind of semi-libertarian positions. And we had not yet I mean, Nixon came along after 64. You know, it was almost 10 years after. Well, 6 years after that. Four years later, Nixon came along. And Nixon's drug law, I think, started in 71, was when Nixon reclassified or recategorized marijuana as a Schedule I drug. And, you know, the whole drug war thing started. But anyhow, the drug war really wasn't going on. I'm guessing if it was, Barry Goldwater would have been taking Rand Paul's positions. But again, people didn't know that. These positions of, you know, don't spy on me, leave people alone in their bedrooms. Now, Rand Paul's a bit of a hypocrite here because he is in favor of laws that criminalize abortion. He is anti-abortion. And so, you know, I mean, it's like catering to the base, right? It's an inconsistency. It's not a real libertarian position, but he's taking that position. But anyhow, here's my thought on this. That because, you know, if he is a serious candidate and if he actually does take the Republican nomination, this could be the thing that pushes a Democratic nominee way to the left, whether it's Hillary Clinton or whether it's Elizabeth Warren or, you know, whoever it is. And that could be the thing that causes 2016 to be the election where things really start getting populist. I mean, the flip side of Rand Paul, Rand Paul is also all in favor of absolutely free trade, right? No restrictions whatsoever on international trade. A Democrat could take him down by saying, let's go back to protectionism. So I think that a whole bunch of positions that I'm very fond of, I'm a protectionist, and you know my position on all these other things. I think it's possible that a Rand Paul presidency on the, or not presidency, a candidacy, excuse me, on the Republican ticket could be a really powerful force to move the Democratic Party and the Democratic candidate and candidates statewide all over the country.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And that would be a remarkable outcome if the Democratic Party had to become genuinely progressive in order to take on a libertarian Republican. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking the truth. Multinational corporations would really rather you weren't discussing, didn't know all about, all that kind of thing. Rand Paul is the 2016 Republican frontrunner. Who would have thought? Jim Turr, who is just does some brilliant satire and music and you know, all kinds of stuff, sends me a note. Comment by a brilliant friend on Australia is having basically eliminated guns after the first big massacre, you know, the kind we have every week here in the United States. He says, and Australia, this is the quote from Facebook by Deborah, and Australia was founded as a penal colony. Many, if not most, of its current white population are literally the descendants of criminals. We were founded by religious freaks and are still basically controlled by religious freaks. Obviously, the criminals have a greater respect for life. Could be. We were actually, I mean, the contemporary Western English-speaking United States of America was actually founded not by the religious freaks. The whole Plymouth plantation and what's the Plymouth Rock and all that, you know, Salem, Massachusetts, all that. That came much, much later. The original was Jamestown, 1607, as I recall. And Jamestown was found, and, you know, the pilgrims came much after. I mean, I don't think that the Cromwell Revolution had even happened at that point. Although I may be wrong. I'm no expert at all in British history. But the first colony in the United States was called Jamestown because it was named after King James, who was the largest stockholder in the British East India Company. Jamestown was established as a trading outpost for the British East India Company and a raw materials acquisition. You know, get us some of those furs, get us some of that stuff. Let's see if you can find any gold, that kind of stuff. And they placed it in a state that they called Virginia after the Virgin Queen, Queen Elizabeth I, who chartered in 1601 the British East India Company. So America was started as a corporate state, not as a theocracy. The theocracy came later, and that was just as up in Massachusetts. And it was very problematic for, you know, when they were putting this country together in the 1780s. Massachusetts was very problematic because they were still largely a theocracy. They had all these blue laws and all this other stuff, and you had to pay taxes to the church, and they literally, in Massachusetts, in large parts of Massachusetts, every Sunday, there were guys whose job was to go around and knock on everybody's door, and if they found anybody who wasn't in church, they would arrest them and put them in stocks and humiliate them. And I mean, you know, this was literally going on when the Constitutional Convention was happening. And it was a big problem for the people who just, like, you know, did not want religion in the Constitution. So, anyhow. And we started out our show today, 2.5 hours ago, talking about how in Australia, when they said, okay, enough with the guns already. Now, my point was, there was a point in this country where we said enough with the slavery already, right? We litigated this with the Civil War, and after the Civil War, we amended the Constitution to take slavery out of it. Enough. It was a founding mistake. The Second Amendment was placed in the Constitution at the urging of Patrick Henry and George Mason, among others, and James Madison, all slaveholders, all Virginian slaveholders. And Patrick Henry, and you can read this online. I've written about this. You could just Google, you know, Second Amendment was for slave patrols, and my name, and you'll find it. And the links right to the original speeches by Patrick Henry and George Mason saying, wait a minute, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution gives the U.S. Congress, actually the executive branch, the president, control over the national militia. Now, if the president has control over the Virginia has a militia. We call it the slave patrol. North Carolina had a slave patrol. Georgia had a slave patrol. You were required, if you were between the ages of 17 and 47 and a white citizen of the state and male, you were required to participate in the slave patrol. And, you know, periodically ride around the back roads looking for runaway slaves. It was to enforce the institution of slavery. These were called well-regulated militias. And that's why the Second Amendment, where's my Constitution? It's like I'm not a gun nut. I can't recite it from memory. I think it says a well-regulated militia being necessary. That's the word. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. Now, throughout the Constitution, they refer to the nation. This is the states. Patrick Henry was saying they're going to take away our militia. They're going to take away our slave patrol. Article 1, Section 8 gives the president the authority to take away our slave patrol. I want the Constitution amended to remove that authority from the president. So what the Second Amendment does is it reverses Article 1, Section 8's and Article 2 of the Constitution that makes the president commander-in-chief of the military. It reverses those two things. Congress's ability to appropriate funds and establish the army, and in Article 1 and Article 2, the president's control over that army. It reverses those and throws the power of the militia back to the states. Now, why would they do that? Because they had slave patrols. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. In other words, we get to keep our slave patrols, and our slave patrols, by the way that we enforce slavery is we got guns. And you find the slaves running around loose, you shoot them. Or threaten them with the guns. So I'm saying, you know, if the Second Amendment was put in there as part and parcel of slavery, and Patrick Henry was absolutely unambiguous about this. I should have printed his speech out before I came on the air today. I later on in the week, tomorrow or Friday, I will print it out and I will read you pieces of it, and you will get what I'm talking about. At both Patrick Henry and George Mason. Patrick Henry was the largest slaveholder in the state of Virginia. Give me liberty or give me death, right? That guy. Yeah, he was the largest slaveholder in the state of Virginia. So why don't we say, you know, we took slavery out of the Constitution. Let's take out of the Constitution the amendment that was put there to enforce slavery in the states at the state level, the Second Amendment. If you want to replace it with an amendment that says the people of America have a right to have weapons so that they can go hunting or they can, you know, for self-defense or for sports shooting or just for the hell of it, that's fine. We can have that conversation. But this is an anachronism, just like slavery is an anachronism, something from a previous era that's no longer of any value whatsoever. Anyhow, I'm going off on a rant, and I've got 12 people on hold here. I'm sorry. Lynette, listening on KPFK in Los Angeles. Hey, Lynette. You want to talk about Rand Paul?
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yeah, it's always something good to hear, you know, as far as information about your show. That's why I listen.
Well, thank you.
And, certainly, you know, and, you know, it's amazing, you know, that we're talking about the Republicrats, who are nothing but the servants of the oligarchy, and that 1% that's at $110 trillion and counting, while the other 50%, bottom half of the 99%, is, you know, is just struggling. And these folks are 65 times more powerful than we are. So, you know, we're looking at global slavery now. Okay,
yeah.
If we let them get away.
It's just by another name. It's sort of a form of feudalism, really.
Right. You know, we let them get away with this because they've robbed everybody to get where they are. So,
yep.
You know, but anyway, I'm just like, why are we even talking about this Democrat and Republican stuff? We need to get a Green Party and a Labor Party, make them merge like these corporations do, and have them to put a candidate out there, because that's really where the heart of the people are anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've watched NAFTA and all these trade agreements, you know, go forth since Clinton up till now. And nothing but their jobs have been exported. The wealth income gap has gotten larger. There's no real redistribution except at the top, not at the bottom. You know, and in fact, now everything that Dr. King said about having a guaranteed income, they're going to try this in Switzerland. They're talking about this now.
Yeah.
So, well, every citizen of Switzerland is going to get $2,800.
It's not going to pass, but they are going to vote on it.
But at least they're talking about
this
distribution of wealth, because you cannot have a planet that and an economy that is working for everyone like it should be. And you know, this is illegal, that $110 trillion that the top 1% have. We all know this.
Well, it's insane. We should, you know, this is why we started a site called NoBillionaires.com, saying that, you know, all wealth over $1 billion should be taxed at 100%. If you can't live on $999 million, you got a problem.
And the other thing that really struck me is, okay, we're going, you really hit the nail on the head when you get to talking about Jamestown. This is a corporatocracy. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a very fine line between a corporatocracy and fascism, from what I understand, because the other definition for fascism is about the corporation and the government.
That is the definition of fascism. It's the merger of corporate and state interests.
Supposed to be a fascist country?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, Mussolini just at least was honest about it. He dissolved parliament and replaced it with the Cameo de Fascistio Corporaciones. He had each congressional district, the largest corporation, got to appoint the member of Congress or the member of the parliament in Italy in 1930, whatever it was, 34 or something like that. And so he was at least up front about it. You know, it's like, we'll just put the corporations in charge. Excellent point, Lynette. Thank you for the call, and thank you for sharing it with us. And thanks for listening to KPFK in Los Angeles. We will be back 15 minutes before the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, taking back the mainstream media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Stick with it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And, you know, let's see if we can get a movement going to repeal the Second Amendment or replace it. Repeal and replace. Have I heard that before? Welcome back. Pam, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Satellite TV Network. Hey, Pam, what's up?
Hi. Just wanted to mention I saw a really good film today. I'm a follower of a film and movies, either on a link or Free Speech TV. Or in the theaters, but I saw this one on Pivot Channel, which is on Dish number 197.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see the beginning, but it's titled 99% The Occupy Wall Street Collaboration Film by Aaron Ites. And it's very good, talking about the issues of our times and footage of the various Occupy movements in the U.S. cities. But a lot of good points were brought up about the economy, foreclosures, the Citizens United. And Matt Taibbi was one of the people featured in it. And just wanted to mention, I haven't heard of this one before. I looked it up. There's a trailer online.
Mm-hmm.
That's all. And it was apparently released on September 6th of 2013.
Cool. I'll have to check that out. I'm guessing probably it's there's something over at Pivot's website about that.
Yeah, it repeats this evening, actually, in a few minutes at 6 p.m. Mm-hmm. on 197 Channel Dish. So
okay.
Just something
cool.
Looks very well done.
Okay. Pam, thanks for the heads up. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Thank you. Van, listening to KPFK in Los Angeles, California. Hey, Van, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Bob. Tom, you were mentioned earlier about the industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us about.
Right.
But one thing I've never heard anybody talk about, and that is after the French were driven out of Vietnam, the Paris Accords had arranged for pre-elections 1 year later, where those in the north could go south and those in the south could go north, and then there would be election.
Yeah, and that was supposed to be, what, 58 or something like that? It was.
Eisenhower did not allow the elections to take place.
Yeah. Now,
had he allowed the elections to take place, Ho Chi Minh would have been elected like 98%.
Sure.
And there would have never been a Vietnam War.
I agree. I'm just trying to remember the timeline because and the reason why I bring that up is that Eisenhower had a massive heart attack in the year before the last year of his presidency. And Richard Nixon was largely running the White House the last year of the Eisenhower presidency. It was pretty corrupt. And I'm just, you know, I'm not speculating here and I'm not trying to defend Eisenhower or blame Nixon, but I just wonder. I don't know what, but it would be interesting to put it on that timeline. Yeah,
I think so.
Yeah, there's so many pieces to that. You know, people say, oh, Kennedy really started Vietnam. No, really, you know, arguably it was the French who started. And Vietnam is a great example of how colonialism, which is what the French were doing, you know, conquer a foreign country and suck their natural resources. And then the Vietnamese rose up, Ho Chi Minh rose up and threw out the French. And then
when the troop ships were ready to bring our boys home, they were diverted to take the foreign legionnaires and all the other French criminals into Vietnam to get their rubber trees back.
Yeah, there you go. And it's an example of how you see these original sins, you see these original errors, like, you know, slavery in the United States is still being played out. And in this case, it's the original sin of imperialism, basically, you know, of empire. Being played out, and we had to then get into that because we were aspiring to be the next empire and be bigger than the Soviet Union and stop Red China and the whole domino theory and all this other nonsense. And the result of that was 2 million people dead in Vietnam and over 50,000, just short of 60,000 Americans dead in Vietnam. It's a mind-boggling tragedy. Van, very thoughtful and insightful comment. Thank you. Thanks for listening to KPFK. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. And Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind?
Well, I tell you, interesting conversation whenever I hear someone talking about gun legislation in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And here's the thing. You remember the other day, matter of fact, it was last week when they showed the charred bodies in Iraq. You know, that our soldiers were responsible for burning bodies and things like that. They showed those pictures
mm-hmm.
Freely here in America. Had no problem with it whatsoever. If you show bullet-riddled children in suburban America or the young guy shot in the head on a street corner in Chicago or the guy who shoots up his whole family in Beverly Hills and then shoots himself. You show those pictures on television, I guarantee you it would have the same effect that the pictures from Vietnam had.
Well, I would submit to you that that's what happened in Australia. In 1996, there was this shooting in Tasmania, in the island off the coast of Australia that's controlled by Australia, where this guy killed 36 people, as I recall. And I could be wrong on this, but I don't think I am. I'm quite sure their news media actually showed the pictures of the bodies. They showed the carnage, and the whole country was so revolted by that that they said enough, and they got a national gun control program. And since then, homicides and suicides have both gone down significantly. And because a lot of homicides and a lot of suicides are you know, what do you call it? Impulse items. You know, they're impulsive acts. And if there's not a gun nearby, it turns into a fistfight instead of a shootout. And exactly. So, you know, after the guns were taken, you know, in Australia, assaults went up. Yeah, people still had fistfights, but murders right. went down and suicides went down. And that's like a good outcome in my mind.
I kind of find it's right up there with me with the founding fathers, how people talk so fondly of the slave owners.
Yeah.
The arrogance sometimes of this country and the media that will say, you know what, we can show their dead bodies, but we can't show the pictures of us. What are we not all human beings?
And yeah, we are.
So ready to show you.
We are. And isn't it amazing, Carl, that here we are, you know, 230 some plus years on from creating a country based on slavery. And I walk around in Washington, D.C., and most of the buildings in downtown D.C. were built by slaves. I mean, the Capitol building was built by slaves. The White House was built by slaves. And you know, people don't think like that when they're walking around looking at this stuff. Here we are 230 years later, and we're just starting to have in our national media a dialogue about this with movies like 12 Years a Slave. And even in that, you still have a white savior in the movie, right?
Absolutely. I mean, you listen, bottom line, and get off the air, man, I'm telling you, they need to show the bodies and to get over this arrogance of showing other countries' bodies, show our bodies, and I guarantee you that will be the end of all these floods of guns in our country because
I'm with you,
would absolutely
I'm
demand
with you.
It.
Yeah, and we're adult enough to see it. After all, we can go to a Bruce Willis movie and we can see lots and lots of bodies. You know, I mean, it's not like we cringe from violence in this country. Very well said, Carl. Thank you. Lucas in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hey, Lucas, you want to talk about gun control?
I do, Tom, and I'm actually in D.C., but I have three quick points. I promise I'll be fast. To the last caller's point, with the Australian gun legislation, isn't it possible that because their society and some of the other societies that you mentioned when you talk about our lack of progressive legislation, isn't it possible that the fact that they're so much more homogenous than us makes it easier for you to sell something like that to the public? That's my first point.
But they're not. They're not. They in Australia, that very much like the United States, you have a country that was already fully occupied by an indigenous group of people, the Aborigines, and you know, white people from Europe came in and started killing them off. Go ahead.
But they don't have a voice like
Oh, they absolutely do. They absolutely do. And Aboriginal politics are. I've been in Aboriginal communities. I've worked in Aboriginal schools in North Queensland and I forget the other state. I'm up where Cairns is. It's spelled Cairns. And in the Lockhart River, I've been there. I mean, they are nowhere near as homogenous as you think they are. Let me just say that.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. My second point would be if the logic you're using for Rand Paul, if the Republicans offer a candidate that has views that can appeal to the middle voter,
mm-hmm.
Like a Libertarian might have, if the Democrats counter that with an extremely progressive candidate, would that not have the same effect that the Tea Party had on the Republicans in pushing that far left for
yes.
the candidate? Could that not turn off some of those middle-of-the-road voters?
It might, but I think not. I think if it was done on an issue-by-issue basis. I mean, with the Tea Party, what has happened is it's become a lightning rod for the troglodytes. It's basically become the last refuge for the racists and the paranoids. And you know, tragically, I mean, the billionaires find that it's very useful to fund this kind of bread and circus thing, keep people entertained, keep them going, keep them outraged. There's a new book about Fox News, the loudest voice in the room, about Roger Ailes and how, you know, he personally is basically paranoid and he's promoting paranoia with his network.
I'm tracking that,
yeah.
I heard about that book. I'm tracking that. And my final point, the biggest reason I call today is because when I have the so-called water cooler wars that you call them,
mm-hmm.
what I find is that a lot of people, you know, especially conservatives, have this belief that wealthy people through their tax dollars supplement our lifestyle to a large degree. My response to that, and I'm interested to hear your thoughts on it, is that globally the poor supplement our lifestyle if not as much, probably more than wealthy tech dollars.
Oh, of course they do. They're doing the work. I mean, they're doing the work that keeps this country going, the poor dude. Yeah, you're right. You're right, Lucas. And, you know, it's like, yeah, absolutely. Well said. Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, I'll be at Families USA Health Action 2014, where I'll be talking to the people on the front lines of the fight for affordable health care. Plus, we'll be talking about the issues of the day with attorney Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire Radio, and my favorite segment of the week, Geeky Science. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It begins with you. Okay, you're it. Get out there, get active, and occupy something. I'll see you tomorrow from live from the Families USA conference.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. EdisonFactor.com. Edison Factor is a supplement for the brain. More information at EdisonFactor.com. SolarWorld.com. SolarWorld has a 35-year history in the manufacturing of solar in America. More information at SolarWorld.com. Carbonite.com. Automatic online backup and file recovery. More information at Carbonite.com. AngiesList.com. Detailed reviews on roofers, plumbers, house cleaners, dentists, and more. More information at AngiesList.com. Stamps.com. Postage online from your computer. More information at Stamps.com. And our website, TomHartman.com. You support our programs, and please help by supporting the people who help make this program possible. There are links to all of our underwriters at TomHartman.com. Thank you.